Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelley.
March 8, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this indeed is the O'Shelley Effect. How do you know that? Because you're hearing the sound of my voice. Anyway, it is Tuesday. It's the second broadcast day normally of the week. But it's been a weird week. And next week, we're going to get right back to it. Anyhow, what is it that I want to talk to you about tonight? Well, we could talk about the current status of war. And in fact, we will. But maybe not the war you want to talk about. Maybe not the war everybody else wants to talk about. Here's the thing. The American people, effectively, are being held hostage. Okay? And what do I mean by that? Well, quite frankly, they're telling us right now, look, the price for not sending your sons and daughters into harm's way is going to be paid at the gas pump right now because of a conflict in Ukraine. And there's your choices, folks. You want to send your children into harm's way. The price, pay it at the pump. Sons and daughters into harm's way, keep that in mind, because here's the thing. The longest standing conflict, the longest standing thing that anybody wants to call a war, as we speak anyway, according to my reckoning, is the drug war. And you know what? There is no option. There is no hostage taking where you can make a deal and pay a higher price at the pump. No, not at all. You pay a lot of higher prices for the drug war, whether you know it or not. And guess what? There's no way to keep your sons and daughters out of harm's way. That's just a fact. And that's enough of my editorializing, because I've got one of the most honorable and absolutely, I mean, I adore this man. I got to tell you, his book, Powder Burns. What can I say about it? Well, what can I say that the title, and he co-authored it. It's his story. But he co-authored it with a man, and I don't know much about the man he co-authored it with, but I do know about the man I'm about to speak with. Cocaine, Contras, and the Drug War. Okay? The subtitle. He was a DEA agent. He had served in Vietnam. He was somebody who said, I will serve and go in harm's way more than one time. Also served as a police officer. Public service. For what? To try and battle a scourge. And what is that scourge? The thing they tell us that we're battling all the time. We're at war with chemicals. We're at war with a drug. We're at war with the business. But that's kind of questionable once you get into his story. And not through any fault of his own. He stepped up and did many things, like I said, to serve. To serve, well, to serve all of us. To be one of those lines of protection. Several times. And what did he get for it, in my opinion? Well, you probably already know. But you're going to find out. In the first hour, we're going to discuss his history. We're going to discuss what's in Powder Burns. And in the second, I want to get this honorable and brilliant man's version, and a strong man who has continued to survive regardless of what either the system or anybody else has tried to do to him. Gotta tell you, I want to get his take on where we stand today with the opioid crisis, with the current flow of this and that and the third thing that we're still supposedly at war with. Celly Castillo, first of all, sir, before we get into telling people your history, as it is, a lot of people that have been listening to my show for years might not have even heard you because it's been way too long since I've spoken to you. So, first of all, thank you for being here. And how are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing okay, and thank you for having me.
I really appreciate you taking the time because, again, you are a unique individual who has come out to speak truth about things based on your experience. So let's start with that experience. You went to Vietnam. You served there. You saw things there that affected you. So could you give us a brief outline? I know you cover it in your book very well, and you've covered it with me before over the years, but it bears repeating. Tell us about Celly Castillo, who is not the first man in his family or not the first man in that time period to step up and say, you know what, I want to defend my country. I want to protect others I want to serve. Tell me about going into Vietnam and, well, the relevant portion of what would later on influence your life decisions, please.
Yeah. Yes. Well, first and foremost, I do come from a very patriotic family where all members of my family on both sides of the aisle served our country. My dad was wounded four times in the Philippines in an ambush. And my uncles, one of them never made it back from the Aleutian Mount Islands back in, up in Hawaii. But needless to say, as the only son in the family, he did instructed me that it was time for me to pay my dues to my country. And it helped me serve in the military. But right prior to that, I was trained at a very young age to be a soldier. He had me in the Boy Scouts and so forth, and I was in track and field, play sports in high school. And as soon as I graduated, I went into United States Army and trained as a scout, as an infantryman, and went to a non-commissioned officer school at Fort Benning, Georgia, and then on to Nam as a infantry sergeant. So I was in, attached to the 1st Cav Division, Bravo Company, and 1st of the 12th, and was up in Benoit, you know, running search and destroy missions. And actually, it was there where we had a firefight and found one of my buddies after the firefight. I found him in the foxhole dead. But it wasn't from a bullet from the enemy that killed him. He had a needle stuck in his arm where he had just shut up heroin. And I made that decision in my life that if I was to survive that war, that I would sign up to be a federal agent with the DEA after living in Vietnam. And that was my decision in life, to become a federal agent and work for the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Were you aware, outside of your friend, that there were a lot of vets who had, well, picked up addictions, some of them surviving and bringing them back home? A lot of vets that, well, quite frankly, again, personal story, my father brought home a heroin addiction after he was there in 68 in the Army. And look, this is not a rare thing. This is not, oh, just a couple of guys came home like this. There were a lot. Were you aware of that at the time?
Absolutely. Government numbers will indicate that is it one-third of the veterans that returned from Vietnam were addicted to drugs.
Yes, sir.
And they did come back. Now, we all know that 58,000 died in Vietnam, but what a lot of people are not aware is that the first year that they came back, close to 100,000 died, whether it was from overdose or whether it was suicide. But that was a large number, from 100,000 to 200,000 had passed away on the first year that they returned from Vietnam because of the addiction.
Well, and some would die later even. My father died, let's see, about 8 years actually after he returned. But the fact is that he struggled with, well, not just the addiction, but other things that he picked up there, specifically PTSD. And again, not a special story. I know it. I know that there were many children of my age who knew their fathers, their uncles, their grandfathers to have been returned one way or another from that conflict in bad shape, Sally. I mean, just directly. And some of it was drugs, you know, but some of it was other things. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very strong statement. They say that those that died in war are the only ones that stopped seeing the war. And people say, well, you survived the war. No, we didn't. We just came back and we tried to adjust because our PTSD, you know, we, a lot of them became alcoholics. A lot of them continue with the drug issues. And like I said, a lot of them committed suicide soon after they returned. Mm-hmm. Now, the Agent Orange stuff that we got is that most of us became diabetics, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, neuropathy, mm-hmm. You name it. We got it because of Agent Orange.
Right.
And for most of you don't understand what Agent Orange is the chemicals that were sprayed to the foliage in Vietnam to try to kill the jungle. And, of course, we're down there on the ground, and we're being sprayed with those same chemicals. And that's what caused us our, you know, the cancer, you name it. Almost every disease that there is to get, we got it. And a lot of us lost our legs, our arms, and eventually died at a younger age because of Agent Orange.
No, there's that, and like I said, I mean, all these things came together, but let's continue on with your story. But for context, I think all of that was very necessary, what we just discussed. The thing is that you carried this image of your friend that you found in the foxhole. You were aware of other things going on. You know about the government numbers now, but at the time, you were moved by this personal experience and decided to go and get yourself in. So tell us what happened next. You come back home, and what did you do?
I came back home. Say, for example, I came back in April, and then in June I started summer school at the university. And at the same time that I was going to school, I had become a dispatcher with the Edinburgh Police Department, and then I became a patrolman. At the end, I became a detective sergeant. But my grades in school were C's and D's. I could barely make it. You know, I was working the midnight shift as a patrolman and going to school during the daytime. And it was very difficult for me to concentrate. But finally did make it. I was still looking, as they say, with the bullet with my name on it. And I was involved in several shootings. And, you know, I was always the first one through the door. I was thinking that I was making a difference in the so-called war on drugs, when in fact I was not. And in December of 1979, I was, after graduating from the university, I was hired by the DEA, and as a federal agent, went to Washington, D.C., to the academy, graduated, and I was hoping that I would be sent somewhere down the border where, being Mexican-American, that I was going to be able to make it a much difference. But in fact, never made it to the border. I was sent strictly to New York City to work undercover on organized crime families in New York City for 4 years.
Right.
Right. I mean, look, it's just a practical thing. If you have an ethnic connection, if you can, I mean, did you speak Spanish fluently at this point, too? So therefore, it would be useful if you were able to go down to the border and well, fight the war there, so to speak.
Yes, my first language in my family was Spanish. My parents were born here, and all my siblings were born here. My grandparents were born in Mexico, but they were raised in the United States.
Right.
So it's, several generations later that, you know, but we never lost our culture, and we spoke Spanish at home and in school, English, of course. So I was bilingual, as they say,
mm-hmm.
and that was hoping to help me out in my career, being sent down to the border.
Right. It makes perfect sense. And obviously, you're now gaining experience as a police officer. and all that. But ultimately, you wanted to go straight to the front line, so to speak, in the drug war, right? And engage directly with what you thought of, or what maybe many people thought of as the most critical part, the where it's coming in, right? I mean, this is the thing. But you wound up being sent elsewhere. And, you know, tell us a little bit about that, please.
Well, in New York City, for example, it turned out to be an opportunity, as they say. If you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere.
Right.
And in New York, I was the first Mexican-American to be assigned to the New York field office. And I was utilized for undercover purposes all over the state. Mm-hmm. And but specifically like New York City and unorganized crime families. Being Mexican American, there was no such thing, and so people would take it lightly that I was not an agent because there were no Mexican Americans in New York City.
Right.
But I was educated into the culture of New York City. And the melting pot and the Italians and the Puerto Ricans and the Cubans and a little bit of, I actually ended up educating myself in that culture that was a melting pot, and it was a big plus. I actually did 4 years in New York City working undercover, and then I was assigned to Latin America at the end of 84.
Right. Now, this is where the story really starts to twist, because, look, as somebody on the ground dealing with organized crime, dealing with the people that are bringing in drugs, you know, to the city directly, you have a feeling that maybe you might be making a difference at that time. And then you go to work with, well, the agency that's dedicated to this. So therefore, just, you know, walking into it, you're thinking, okay, now I'm upgrading, I'm coming to it. You know, but that experience didn't last too long where you had that in your mind, did it?
That's correct. You know, at the beginning, once I arrived in Latin America, I found out that we were the enemy. Found out that the CIA was heavily involved in the drug trade to support their covert operations. And at first, I was in denial. But then I realized that we were running drugs into the United States and guns back for the Contra operations, and I was devastated because that was not what I had signed up for. And
right.
Like in New York City, I ended up doing a lot of undercover work in Latin America. I was traveling to different countries, Colombia. I was traveling to Peru. Down Leticia, Colombia, doing deep undercover work, and found out that the CIA had cut a deal with Pablo Escobar, and we were refueling planes coming in from South America to Latin America, and hoping that those airplanes would get busted as they entered the U.S. airspace, but that never happened. It was just a CIA covert operation that was being run, and that's how we initiated what was called the crack epidemic, mm-hmm. with Freeway Ricky down on the West Coast, and who cornered the market on the crack epidemic, and they were funding him. CIA informants were funding him. Glenn Don was funding him. Kilos and kilos of cocaine, and Freeway Ricky was making close to $10 million a day, something like that. Mm-hmm. Outrageous number. And of course, it was the CIA that was funneling all these drugs to different operators all over the United States.
Well, just a note for the listeners, if you go way back in my archive, you'll actually find the first time that Celly Castillo was on a radio show with Freeway Ricky Ross in my archives, and we discussed this very same thing. Oddly, off air, I had a discussion with Ricky about it, because, and I don't think I've ever told you this, Celly, in a way, I was I was a street kid, you know, at the time, and I was much younger, but made part of the trade, you understand. So Ricky and I commiserated over exactly how it is all of a sudden we had access to urban chemistry. You know, the formula for crack just was there. It just showed up one day. And I was on the East Coast. He was on the West Coast. We were never in contact with one another or anything like that. But him and I, you know, talked about a very similar experience that it almost came off to us on the street level, Sally, as if this was a completely coordinated and planned thing. But we felt like the criminal elements were in charge, and they were large and in charge, and they happened to be the guys that we could make money with, you know, trying to survive on the streets, Sally. I'm not saying it's a good thing, and I'm not celebrating it. I'm saying that due to circumstances, a street kid like me going back and forth between New York and New Jersey, and him out there in California, right? This is what just came to us, Sally. You know, and it was very strange. Meanwhile, you're down there, supposed to be stopping this from coming our way.
And basically what happened there, a dear friend of mine, agent, Kiki Camarena, was tortured and killed by elements of the CIA and the cartel from Guadalajara. Felix Gallardo and Fonseca and all those people were heavily involved in the drug trade, and Kike was trying to make a difference, and he was captured, tortured, and buried alive. And the allegation is the fact that Felix Rodriguez, the CIA asset, was at the house where Kike was being tortured, mm-hmm. and took part of the interrogation on Kiki Camarena. That's on Hector Bareilles' documentary on Prime, Amazon Prime. So there are stories that have been broken since the murder of Kiki Camarena. And there's also a documentary called The American Drug War on Amazon Prime, where I'm on episode 2, and they actually did an outstanding job on that episode, because they found footage of me in Central America that I've never seen before. So it also gives them the story of my participation and what was about to happen to me. What had happened to Kike was about the same thing that was going to happen to me, because I canceled a U.S. visa to a Guatemalan colonel who was going to a war college for the CIA in Washington, and I canceled his visa because he was heavily involved in the drug trade. Right. And I took a hit. That colonel put a contract out on me, and it was tape recorded and everything, to where I was going to be assassinated on my way from Guatemala to El Salvador, and blame it on the guerrillas down in Salvador.
Well, right. But this wasn't the first indication you had that your superiors were not looking out for you, because, spoiler on this for anybody listening who doesn't know, they sent you back out in the field knowing that you had a contract on your head, didn't they?
Right. And when the information, the intelligence came out that I was going to assassinate him, my boss, Bob Stia, ordered me to go to Salvador and work undercover on a Salvadoran general who was selling deceased weapons that they were grabbing from the guerrillas to the drug cartels. And I was playing part of being a member of the drug cartels, but I was buying weapons from him. And I had to travel from Guatemala City to El Salvador to conduct that undercover operation. And that's when they were going to hit me in Salvador and blame it on the guerrillas.
Which, by the way, would have been a dangerous thing to do without the contract on your head, because at this time there was so much upheaval, there were the death squads going on. I mean, this was hazardous work to begin with, Sally, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Actually, what we did was the DEA did was we trained what was known as the death squads in Salvador and in Guatemala. The Mano Blanca, which was the Guatemalan G2, the death squads there that were killing a lot of people. And the other ones that we trained was the Ataclat battalion in El Salvador, which was run by the CIA. And that's where they shot and killed Archbishop Romero. And, you know, close to half a million Central Americans were murdered by the hands of the CIA.
Yes.
Yes, all true. I don't think I've ever asked you about this before either, but let's just get at it. Mora Salvatrucha, right? And I'm probably mispronouncing that. But you know what I'm referring to here, a paramilitary organization which later on morphs into what we call MS-13 today. Do you have any direct knowledge about that and how that occurred?
Yes, a lot of the Mala Salvatrucha people back in the 80s were military. Mm-hmm. Salvadorians became the Hondurans and the Guatemalans, and after we kind of disowned them, they left their country to go to the United States, and it was there that they organized, and because of their expertise in a military scene, they started building those units. Mm-hmm. Their own units, and became one of the biggest gangs in the United States, and of course a lot of them were deported and went back to their countries. But they were very well organized. They spoke English. They knew how to make money, and you know, going back to drugs and arms and everything else. So, you know, you ask why they come to the United States. It's because we started a massacre down in Latin America with all these death squads. Mm-hmm. And the people were running scared, and were coming to the United States to have a better life because their country wasn't safe. Right. And that's the reason we had the waves of all these undocumented immigrants going into the United States and try to survive.
Right. I mean, it is just the natural conclusion to what was started there with all of this, you know, all of this action going on, much of it illegal, most of it illegal, in fact, the things that led to the Iran-Contra scandal all being in play. And meanwhile, as we've said several times, you're there trying to make a difference. So I wonder if you could tell me what your first indication was that perhaps you were living through a situation where the fox was guarding the hen house, so to speak. I mean, when did it first come to you that this was like something's wrong?
It first came to me when Reagan won the election. There was a guy named Alarcón. Mm. He was known as the godfather of the death squads in Guatemala. And he was invited by Reagan to participate on the inauguration party. And he did show up over there, and there are photos of him with Reagan. Now, this guy was known as head of the death squads, the godfather of the death squads in Latin America. And that was my first indication. The second indication was when George Bush, when Vinicio Cerezo was the first Democratic president, not really the first, but he was new, and George H.W. Bush came down as the representative of the United States government to help celebrate Cerezo's becoming president.
Right.
And it was at the ambassador's house. I think his name was Piera. He was a Cuban exile also, but he was the ambassador to Guatemala from the U.S. Right. And George H.W. Bush showed up at a cocktail party. And, you know, I hated to go to places like that because I'm a field guy. I don't, not much of a diplomat. And, but I was asked that I needed to attend, and I was there. And at that same time, we had the Contras in Salvador running drugs to support their covert operations. And we had Oliver North meeting with the Contra leaders, and they were involved in running drugs in hangars 4 and 5 at Ilopango that was owned and operated by the CIA. And I ended up seizing several kilos of cocaine and airplanes there also. Anyway, to make a long story short, I was standing there by the bar having a drink, and Bush comes up to me and he says, "Well, so what is it you do for our government?" And I said, "Well, glad you ask. I'm a DEA agent, and I represent Salvador and Guatemala and Belize and Honduras. And we have gathered intelligence that the Contras are heavily involved in the drug trade." And it was then and there, he shook my hand, he just smiled and walked away from me. And I knew that it went all the way up to the White House that they were implicated in drug trafficking and arms and so forth in Latin America.
Right. I mean, he had nothing to say to you, and we're talking about the vice president, right, at this time?
That's correct. He was the vice president of the United States at that time period.
Right.
And we were gathering a lot of intelligence coming in from Costa Rica, coming in from Colombia, coming in from the U.S. We had FBI, we had U.S. Customs. Everybody was documented, including myself. I wrote lots of files, and I still have some of those files of the intelligence that we were getting on drug trafficking,
right?
By the U.S. government, and that was very well established.
Well, what you were finding in the field, not because you were looking for it, but because it was just there, is that individuals that were supposed to be involved in slowing it, in stopping it, in catching the guys doing it, one way or another, were directly involved in actually doing it. Which, you know, this isn't something you went to go find, but it was there. And then you actually tell the vice president to his face that something
exactly.
is very wrong here.
I mean, it's wrong. And I mentioned we're putting our lives on the line here, and it's like they really didn't care about us. We were collateral damage, as they say. Kike had just been murdered, and the U.S. government didn't care.
And, well, as far as they were concerned, the term would be expendable, wouldn't it? You're expendable.
Exactly. Yeah, we're expendable. You know, the sad thing about it, they didn't even hide what they were doing. They just did it out in the open. And the reason they were doing that, because there was a CIA asset by the name of Randy Capister,
right,
who once told me, he said to me that, you know what, Sally, I don't know why you're writing reports on the drug trade down here. The American people are very ignorant. They get all excited for a couple of months, and then they forget all about it. He says, this is the way we do business in Latin America. We've been doing it for years, and we'll continue. You and I will be gone, and they will still be doing the same thing that we're doing now.
Seems
and
like,
I said, well, yeah, that's not what I signed up for. And secondly, you know, I will continue to write my reports and then let the chips fall where they may.
Well,
that was my thought on that, and sure enough, we later got what was known as the Iran-Contra investigation. And it revealed a lot of the intelligence that we were putting out.
Well, it had to, if anybody was going to bother to read the paperwork that's being compiled, that if anybody's going to bother to look at what it is people are being hired to do. But here's another question I don't think I've ever asked you. Did they attempt to buy you off at all? Was there a move to say, look, Sally, how about we just cut you in? And, you know, stop writing your reports. Stop making trouble for us here. Why don't we just bring you in on it? You can have some money. We'll hook you up. Did they ever make an approach like that? I mean, because that would be normal,
yeah,
wouldn't it?
They did, because what they were doing, the U.S. government, the CIA, was bringing in their assets from all over South America. Was known as they were bringing in goon squads from Venezuela, and they worked for the CIA, and these guys were getting filthy rich because they were whatever money they were seizing from the Colombians, they were keeping it. And the same thing with some of the my DEA colleagues down there were making lots of money refueling the planes that were loaded with cocaine. And you could tell right away the way they dressed. They had toys in Miami and elsewhere, and you could tell that they were living above their means. Mm-hmm. But with me, it was I learned that in New York City, that once you take something, then you're compromised.
Right.
And it'll never be the same. So I never did. I left poor as I went in poor. But, I kept my integrity intact.
No. Yeah, absolutely. That was the point I wanted you to make, by the way. I don't mean to suggest in any way that you would have taken it. That's the point. That's why I'm talking to you. You're the guy who, regardless of what the system says it's doing, you went there to do the honest job, and this is what you got. A hit put out on you, and people telling you, look, why do you bother? And this is the way it went. How did you wind up getting out of that circumstance, first of all, alive? Because, as we said here, your bosses knew that the enemy, so to speak, had a hit out on you. They sent you into harm's way anyway. You got out of that, but how did you get out of the circumstance? Because it almost seems like, again, it's a wonder they didn't have you killed some other way, or put you in a position to get killed some other way, because, hey, you were going to make trouble just by doing your job, weren't you?
Yes. I think what bothered them, that I was a Vietnam vet, that I had fought for my country already, that I was awarded a Bronze Star for bravery in Vietnam, and they knew that there was nothing in the world that they were going to be able to do to stop that. And they said, well, if they, this guy has written so many reports, have taken so many pictures, that if we take him out, all this will be exposed. And I did tell him. He said, something happens to me or my family, all these reports, I have copies of them. They've been sent out to different parts of the United States. And the day I die, then it's going to come out.
Right.
So they were scared of that. And they also were scared, because I did show it to them, that I had Colombian passports, Mexican passports of all the people that were murdered down in Central America.
Right.
I kept those passports because I knew that would be my ticket not to get whacked. But I had to leave because it was getting close, that there was a possibility that I was making so many enemies that they were not going to know who actually, if the Colombians were going to come in and take me out for what, some of the seizures that I've made, over 3,000 kilos on one load. Mm. where several Colombians were murdered.
Right.
Actually, Pablo Escobar came and sent a hit squad to Guatemala to take me out and some of the other people that were involved in this seizure of the 3,000 kilos. And so, you know, it was getting to that point, and they finally took me out of Guatemala or Latin America, and they hit me in San Diego for over a year.
Right.
I was hidden. I was living out of hotels. I was just, finally, I was assigned to San Francisco in 90 to 92, and it was there that I got set up to get murdered by some Mexican drug cartels, and I almost did get assassinated there, but I, thinking smart, I just made it. I went, when it went down, I went to my office, drove to my office in the undercover vehicle, which was a Mercedes,
okay,
and went to the office. Got a cardboard box and put all my belongings in there in the office, and I threw the gun and the badge to my supervisor, and I told him, I'm out of here. I'm done with you guys.
Right.
He says, what do you mean? He says, I quit. I almost got murdered out there today because you guys did not do what you were supposed to do, and I'm not going to take that chance. And it just happened that my daughter had called me,
right,
and I picked up the phone, and she said, Dad, when are you coming home? We haven't seen you in over a year. And I said, well, I'm working to, you know, to make money so I can buy you guys clothes and toys and stuff like that. And my little girl said to me, she says, Dad, we don't want toys. We don't want clothes. We want you to come home.
Right.
So I got on the next plane, and I left. Now, you're asking me how dedicated of an agent I was. In my 12 years with the DEA, I called in sick one time because I had a fever of 105. That was the only day that I called in sick in all those 12 years. So I had sick leave to use for more than 6 months. So I took that and I went home and retired from the DEA.
You start out with 6 months paid sick leave, so might as well collect that, and then and then retired.
And then retired, exactly. And what happened was, you know, I had a compound dosage of PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it actually was my third time, because the first time I got PTSD from my dad, because my dad had been shot 6 times, and you know, he had severe PTSD.
Right.
And then I got that from him and the family, and then I got it from Vietnam, and then I got it from the DEA.
Right, right.
Because of all the murders and torturing and waterboarding and everything else that happened down there, I was exposed to.
Right.
So I went out on a disability from the DEA for PTSD. Plus, I had military service and government service that came up to 20 years of service.
Right.
Well, in this way, I mean, 20 years of service and rough time, really. So the next logical question for me, because I want to skip ahead a little bit here, is at a certain point you start to reveal some of these things, and one might think, you know, aren't you scared? Weren't you scared? You know, tell us about maybe even being a source for somebody we might know, since you mentioned San Diego. I was thinking to myself, well, Gary Webb, you know, in that situation, and you start revealing some of these things to people. I mean, weren't you again feeling like maybe you're putting your life in danger inform people?
The incident that happened in San Francisco, where I called in the bus signal for them to take these guys out, and nobody came. Nobody was opening the doors, or nobody was, you know. I said, well, maybe my mic's not working, right? So the visual was for me to pop the trunk, and once I popped the trunk, that was the signal to take the guys down. And I popped the trunk, and nobody came. Now, the guys were asking me for the money. I said, it's in the trunk. And the guy says, well, get the money. So that wasn't even supposed to happen. And I reached into my gym bag where I had my gun in there, but I couldn't remember if I had a round in the chamber or not, because I knew that the shooting was about to happen.
Right.
So I felt my gun in the bag. I didn't even take it out. I just raced it with the bag, and I was hoping that I still had a round in the chamber. And when I did that, the guys, you know, they saw me pointing the back at them. They fell back and they went for the gun. So when they fell back, they moved back about maybe a couple of yards. That's when the doors of the van opened and everybody came out with the guns drawn, and they disarmed them.
Right.
But prior to that, I knew that something was going to happen to me. So I secretly contacted FBI agent Foster from Lawrence's World Committee. And I met with them secretly without the DEA knowing. And I gave them all the information I had on the U.S. government involved in the drug trade.
Right.
And, of course, Lawrence, what was his name? Walsh. Lawrence Walsh, a special prosecutor for Iran-Contra. And I came back with Mike Foster and told the FBI agent that he had cut an arrangement with the U.S. government that he was not going to expose the U.S. government's drug trafficking operation.
Right.
So that was not relieved, but I did give them copies of everything that I had,
right,
which, of course, they went into the files and they were sealed. So that was that, and then I wrote my book in 94. I left 92 and 94, I wrote my book, and I exposed everything that I had to expose. People started reading my book, and then the nail in the coffin was when I did a special with John Quiñones on Primetime Life.
Okay.
And they went down to Guatemala, and they did the story on the 3,000 kilos that was seized, and the people and the girls that were murdered down there during that operation. Okay, so what happened next? Soon after that was aired, 2 days later, I get a knock at the door. And it's the U.S. Marshals. And what they were serving me with papers to go before a federal grand jury in Washington, D.C. It was the same grand jury that the Hillary Clinton went through on Whitewater.
Right.
It was the same grand jury. So he says, you got to be in Washington. They gave me the airline tickets. They gave me the subpoena. You got to be up there so-and-so date. So I did. I flew to Washington, D.C. and met with Mike Toback, who was the Assistant United States Attorney. And he took me for the grand jury, before the grand jury. And, of course, it was an ambush.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to get me to lie and so forth, and they wanted to know about the John Quiñones story. And I said, well, before you hear that, you got to hear the history of how he got there.
Right.
And he said, no, we're not going to listen to that. We just want to know. He says, no. He said, you're going to hear it. He said, I'm taking my gloves off because they got hustled with me. And I started telling them about the murders, the death squads, the drug trafficking, tail numbers, passports numbers, case numbers. And they were just shocked that I had all that.
Right.
And then they said, well, when after, I think, 2 or 3 hours of grand jury testimony, I left, and Mike Tobak, I think was his name, Tobak or something like that, he says to me, Shelley, I apologize to you, but I had my orders.
Right.
And I had to do what I had to do. I said, that's okay, I understand. He says, how were you able to remember everything? I says, because I kept journals.
Right.
I kept pictures. And I have the documents. And I have everything to prove my allegations. And he was just like, oh, my God. And then he says, did you bring that with you? I said, absolutely not. And then he said, will you do me a favor? Can you send it to me? He said, yes, I'll send them to you when pigs fly. And, of course, I didn't send them to him. But during some of the lectures I went through all over the country, I was able to expose the case files, the files, for example, Oliver North, where in 1991 he was selling weapons in the Philippines to the guerrilla network down there.
Right.
And so it's, you know, it's government documents. It's got NATO's numbers on him. You know, and then I went down to Virginia where he ran for U.S. Senate, and he was defeated because of the information that I released on him at that time period.
Well, I am surprised that somebody has not reprinted Powder Burns. You know,
well, this is what happened now on Powder Burns. Of course, I never got the royalties from the publisher, and the publisher, to just recently, about a year ago, he was still selling my book and not giving me any profits at all whatsoever. So finally got an attorney, cease and desist from selling them, because I do have the rights back.
Uh-huh.
From the publisher that he turned over in 1986 to me. And so I had the rights to my book and my story. And he thought, because I lived down in South Texas, that there was, I would never be around. So I sold my option to my book about a year ago.
Oh.
Because they're doing a documentary on my story. And they got a few more months left before my rights will be reversed to me if they don't do anything. Mm-hmm. And they're looking to pitch it at Amazon Prime or Netflix, where they're going to do a series on it.
Well, I really hope they do, because, look, your story, and by the way, if somebody out there does acquire a copy of this book, there are some very interesting images in it. I'm sure you would love to touch it up again, though, if somebody very seriously wanted to get involved with, you know, paying you for it, that would be a good thing.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, we're going to redo the book.
Okay.
And it's going to be, you know, we're trying to release it at the same time that we release the documentary or the series.
Right.
And, yes, that will be touched up. Everything will be better. And hopefully we can do that, have that done.
Well, look, make me a deal here, though, Shelley, that the moment that happens, that I can still get you on my show, because
absolutely. But like I said, right now, the American Drug War, that's on Prime, Amazon Prime, episode two. I'm like 49 minutes into episode two where they start talking about me.
Right, as they should, because you're one of the very few people that has come forth with this kind of information. I'm not saying there isn't a few other people that have, but, I mean, reality is we would not know as much as we do, regardless of whether you were paid for it or anybody even knows your name sometimes. You informed us all about this on such a wide scale. I don't think you've ever been given the credit you deserve for doing so. And look, we're going to take a break in a few minutes here. And when we do, we're going to come back on the other side and discuss, well, a little more current events. And I want to get your take on a few things, if you don't mind. But look, this book again, and look for the new one when it comes out, because I know I'm going to get it. I'm definitely going to want that documentary. You know, if they put it on Prime, whatever, I want to find a way to get myself a copy of it that I can hold in my hands. Because you never know what happens with these streaming services and stuff. You know, truth is, this is a story that needs to be told repeatedly. And the final thing that I'd like to ask, like I said, is about how you end up becoming a source. And you mentioned a couple of television shows you were on, but I've seen you clipped into all kinds of stuff related to the drug war, Iran-Contra. And good thing, because you're a first-hand witness. You're a guy, which, by the way, interesting thing there where they tell you, well, you know, do you have the evidence with you and all that? And the fact is that, you know, you didn't just have a story to tell. You were a trained investigator, so you retained the information and knew how to retain that information so that it could be something that they could work with, the tail numbers, you know, exact dates and times and, you know, different things that could lead somebody to all of the information and connect it together across, well, different agencies, I'm sure, across, you know, different other witnesses that could verify and back up things that you were saying. Unfortunately, some of the people that, well, knew things died along the way because, well, after all, this is an ugly thing. They call it a war for a reason, but to me, you know, again, in the second hour, I'll probably get into what you think about things today and maybe throw at you my entire idea about drug prohibition, and we'll discuss that for a moment, because, you know, to me, this is not about the drugs. It's about the damage that is done, and the fact is that the people that are supposed to be preventing that damage in some cases, not you, but so many seem to be participating in doing the damage as opposed to preventing it. And at some point, we got to get honest about it in this country and maybe just, you know, in our time about what's really going on here, what continues to go on, and what we can do about it. I mean, how do you feel about that, Sally?
Yes, absolutely. And remind me when you get back, I'll tell you a little story of some of the murders that happened that I was approached a few years back on one of the cases. Oh. And it's a very interesting case. I don't know if I ever told you about it or not, but maybe not. But it's something new that people will find it astonished that happened. But remind me when we get back.
No, I'll definitely do that. And as I said before, we're talking to Sally Castillo. In my opinion, a really undersung or unsung hero in the American story of the drug war. A guy who laid his life on the line several times to serve us, to serve all of us, indeed. And frankly, in my opinion, was betrayed and put aside, and it's a story that you've got to hear if you want to understand anything about what they call the drug war. Period. There's nothing else to be said. The Ocelli Effect will continue with Sally Castillo after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Revelation through conversation.
When a fan of the Ocelli Effect calls in to the Ocelli Effect.
I just wanted to call in and tell you and Michael Swanson and JP Sicilian, all of the guests that you have, how much I love your show. Always interesting. It's always informative. I just wanted to tell you in person on the phone. I mean, I love you. I love your show. I love everything you do. I will always be there to support you. You know that.
We appreciate you so much. You have no idea.
Thanks. And most of our fans just send hate mail and death threats.
Ocelli.com.
In Denial. Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com and all of the other affiliate places where this gets played. And by the way, I'm sure I'm going to be able to send this out to the AM and FM affiliates that we have after we're done, because this is one of the most important shows I've done in a very long time. And it's not because of me. It's because of my guest, Celly Castillo. Now, he is the author of Powder Burns, and that's kind of an old book. But as we found out in the first hour, there will be a new version of it coming up. Hopefully a full-length either documentary or documentary series. And you've seen Celly Castillo. If you've ever been interested in the drug war, in cocaine and Contras, which is part of the subtitle of the book, but if you've ever been interested in that part of American history, recent modern history, if you've ever been into that, you've probably seen Celly in these documentaries in small or large doses. Want to know why? Because he's required reading. And I'm really pleased to have him with me. And now, in this second hour, we're going to go beyond the story from the 80s and the early 90s. But we may have to go back in time just a touch, because Celly says he has some information about something that I probably don't know about, and I'm sure Celly knows a lot about things that that I'm not privy to when it comes to this subject. And of course, his life experiences, even though there's a whole book, doesn't mean that's the whole of his experiences. So, Celly, please go ahead and tell us about this.
Yeah, well, several years ago, after my book came out, I have it documented in my journals. Anyway, I get an email from the daughter of one of the Colombians that was murdered by the CIA on that operation where the 3,000 kilos of cocaine came were seized. Several Colombians and Mexicans, females, Mexicans, and their father were murdered. And what she was saying to me, I read the book. He said, I just want to know, and my mom wants to know, what happened to my dad. Because my mom still does not move anything in the bedroom. It's the same way that it was when my father left. And my mom, you know, still hopes that one day he's going to show up.
Now, just to be clear, Celly, but before you go further, just to be clear, you're talking about that raid that you mentioned in the first hour where eventually Escobar himself sends out a hit squad for you.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Just to be clear.
And these Colombians worked directly under Pablo Escobar.
Okay.
And she told them, you know, she told me, yeah, they worked for him. And they were good at what they did. But we just want to know. And I said to her, I said, yes, he took one behind the head and he died quickly. When the matter, fact of the matter is that he was tortured with the girls, the Mexican contacts. They were all tortured completely. And I remember her father strictly, because the Guatemalan G2 could not find the drugs in the mother vessel, the Daring. It was a former Canadian Coast Guard vessel flying the Panama flag. And it docked in Puerto Barrios, and it was loaded. They loaded the drugs there in Guatemala. And what happened was they flew the loads into, you're not going to believe this, the fincas that were owned by Damanti and Libby. And they put them on the rail trucks, and they in the middle of the night, they took it and they put it in the vessel. Well, they brought the Colombian, and he was in his shorts. They brought him onto the vessel, where he took them to where the drugs were stashed. And what happened was they had welded the plate already on it, so nobody could find it. It was in the hull of the vessel. Anyway, he did it because they promised him that he would not be killed. Well, of course, they were all murdered. Actually, the CIA has a video on them, what happened to them. They cut them all up, and they put them in 55-gallon drums and took them out to sea and just dropped them. The drums, they drill holes into them, and so they sank to the bottom of the ocean.
Right.
Never to be found again. Anyway, the daughter had wanted to know what had happened, and she emailed me, and I emailed her back, and so forth. And she said, "Well, my mom wants to file a wrongful death against the United States government for what happened to my dad."
Okay.
But, we don't feel we should do that. Anyway, a couple of months later, they contacted me again, and they decided to go do that. So they flew to Houston, and I met them in Houston, and I had my documents with me. And I showed it to them, and I said, "Well, we're going to go ahead and file a wrongful death against the United States government." Well, they couldn't find an attorney, whether New York City or Florida or anywhere, that would take the case. Because imagine these lawyers trying to go against the government.
Yeah.
They would be burning their bridges, and that never happened. And needless to say, well, they fail on their attempt to do that. And they couldn't find anybody to take the case.
Well, the first problem would be, Selly, of course, to go after a wrongful death suit, you got to prove somebody's dead. And if indeed it is as you described, unless somebody's documented it,
that's what happened, was because I did document it then.
Uh-huh.
And actually, in the Primetime Life story, It says in the story that I documented it, and I took pictures, and I have the passports. And the murders did happen because it was videotaped by Randy Capster, the CIA asset.
Right.
The allegation was that he took pictures of the people that were being tortured.
Right.
So you actually have the evidence they would need to go forward.
Yeah. Well, it is. The problem is that they were so scared that, well, people kept saying, "Well, statute of limitations been over so many years." I said, "But there's no statute."
Not on murder.
Of limitations for murder.
Right.
But they just, they couldn't find the right attorney to take the case.
Oh.
And that's how it fell. But it just goes back to what. Because I wrote the book, they read it and they were concerned about their father.
Of course.
And they wanted to know the story behind it.
Well, look, no matter what our parents or our loved ones do, right? I mean, when they disappear, you want to know. You want to know the answers. I mean...
They want to put closure on it. That's what it is.
Well, yeah, and and no, exactly.
Yeah.
And look, all right. Look, I don't want to delve into my personal thing too much, but again, my father's death was under kind of strange circumstances. They investigated it, found it was a suicide, but I wound up going and independently reinvestigating it because there were unanswered questions. And I mean, he didn't just disappear one day. And who knows what the actual explanation that came back to them was as to where he went or if he ever went anywhere. If any explanation was ever offered before, and then they get one from your book. I mean, that's just amazing to consider, right? I mean...
Yes, that's crazy because it's something that brings radical credibility to my allegations.
Of course.
You know, and that's huge, and it needs to be addressed. One of the persons that there was the John Kerry committee almost went into this drug trafficking murders, because during his hearings we had the knowledge of how money was laundering for the CIA to run those covert operations, but at no time did he ever contacted me. And the reason he never contacted me was because I did get a call from DEA headquarters, individual by the name of John Marsh. And John Marsh said to me, called me in Guatemala and said, do not close your cases down in Salvador and Guatemala. I says, why not? He says, because if you close them, then John Kerry and his people, Lawrence Walsh, everybody's going to be able to get copies of the reports. Uh-huh. And if it stays open, it's an ongoing investigation.
Right. As long as it's...
And that's what they were going to use to not to release the documents.
Right. If it's an active investigation, and rightfully so, right,
yeah,
then it's not a good idea to reveal these things publicly or put it on the record, because it could compromise an ongoing investigation. I mean, it's very simple.
Yeah.
And on all levels of law enforcement, you'll hear this all the time. Ongoing investigation. We can't give you that information right now because could compromise, could actually influence what's going on here. And it's logical, but if it's being done intentionally, it's another thing here, isn't it? Where, you know, look, don't close your cases. Even if you, as the investigator, feel as though, look, I've done as much as I can, I need to close this out, no good, because that would make it, well, we can't be interfering with something that's already done. And therefore, the information could now be sent through the channels and, lead to another investigation, right? So,
right. Mm-hmm. And that's what they wanted to happen. And that's why... Felix Rodriguez, Oliver North got away with murder and with the drug trafficking operations and so forth. And just keep in mind that there were a lot of pilots that flew for them that testified before the committees.
Right.
But because of the credibility, it didn't go far, you know?
Well, they didn't have enough to back up their stories, right?
Right,
so
right.
This was the trouble. Now, the trouble for people that don't want those stories to come out is, first of all, Celi Castillo. Secondly, there could be a couple other Celi Castillos, no offense, that have some records. I'm sure you're not the only guy that was told, look, knock it off, leave this alone, or do this a certain way because... And
The thing about it, the difference is that I documented just about every single pilot that flew for the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
I have their names, tail numbers, and where they came in, whether it was Salvador, whether it was from John Hall's ranch in Costa Rica, right, to Guatemala, to Salvador, both American pilots and the domestic pilots in Latin America.
Right.
Almost every single one of them. So all these people I've documented properly, because that's just what I do.
Well, you know, in a normal world, Celi, this would be called doing your job. That's what you were doing. And I hate to put it like that. It sounds like I'm making a joke here, but I'm not. That's what you were doing. The problem is that maybe not everybody wanted you to do your job.
It did start that way. At first, they didn't care.
Mm.
They didn't care because that's the way they do business. Business is done as usual in Latin America.
Right.
But when those hearings started popping up, they said, uh-oh, you know. But by that time, I was documented everything that was to be documented,
right?
Including my boss and the other agents and the intelligence I was getting from Costa Rica DEA, telling me to investigate Sanger 4 and 5, that they had intelligence, there were a lot of drugs being run in there. So it wasn't only me. It was Bobby Nieves out of Costa Rica, the country attaché, who was telling me that drugs were being run into Hangar 4. And, of course, Hangar 4 and 5 was run by Felix Rodriguez, the Cuban exile that was a CIA asset. And the other one was from Oliver North, who was tied to the Bush, directly with Bush when Bush was vice president.
Right, right.
So, you know, and it's very well documented. And then if you look at the final report on Iran-Contra, you will find that it's very well documented. A lot of the pilots are there, but not all of them.
Right.
But, you know, they try to throw a little bit here, a little bit there. But, of course, they're in denial that they ran drugs and this and that. When, in fact, we knew we had a lot of pilots in Guatemala that were flying for the CIA,
right.
That would crash down in Costa Rica, and they were hospitalized in Miami and in the U.S. I mean, in Guatemala.
Well, I got to tell you too. That yeah. In studying different criminal things that have gone on, different murders, different assassinations, various things having to do with the drug business, so to speak. Quite frankly, Felix Rodriguez is a name that pops up a lot. You know, this guy's not just in one place. And I know you have a firsthand idea about that, but you're not the only one. This guy keeps showing up in a lot of places where bad things are happening, to put it bluntly. So, you know, sometimes people are good at their jobs, even if it's an ugly job and it's a criminal job, they keep getting hired to do it.
Right. And you have the, you know, the CIA has a history. Going back to the Vietnam War, the heroin epidemic.
Yes, sir.
The triangle down there that I think Mike Levine was a DEA agent assigned to Vietnam on the investigation of the CIA involving in the drug trade, smuggling heroin in body bags.
Right.
From Vietnam and so forth. So they go back with the history of that. You have Operation, I think, Eagle, where Felix Rodriguez, the Cuban exiles, were all involved in the heroin epidemic in the 70s. And they were all hired. They were all Cuban exiles hired by the CIA.
No, you go into the Phoenix program, you go into...
Exactly.
All the stuff with, you know, the Golden Triangle there. I've tried to discuss this and you know, talking to people like Doug Valentine, who's an excellent writer on it, you know, who studied this. And I'm sure you're familiar with Doug Valentine's work.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Strength of the Wolf, Strength of the Pack, right? You know, so on and so forth. I mean, I'm not trying to get into all that with you right this second, because really I want to, and by the way, not just... that situation with Levine, who got into, you know, the whole investigation about the smuggling. We know about what people would call the American gangster story, Frank Lucas and his organization. Yeah. Again, using a dead serviceman to smuggle plenty of smack into this country. But these guys weren't even the major players. They're the ones
right.
that got busted. They're the ones that got, you know, run through the system eventually. But
yeah, and it's so funny because down the triangle up there, it was very well documented on numerous documentaries where the CIA ended up buying the heroin from the general down there because they claimed that the guy had gotten so big that they were just flooding the streets of the United States, that they wanted to buy all the heroin. And there's a there's a documentary called, and it was for HBO. It was called Warriors of the CIA. Mm-hmm. There were several series on it.
Right.
And it goes right into the Vietnam, the heroin, the smuggling, who was smuggling, and so forth.
Yes, sir.
But it's very well documented. It's just like I tell everybody. He said, we need somebody that's going to write a book, because all this information is like a puzzle.
Right.
You have to get all your pieces together and then put them in order, and then you'll have the complete history of the war on drugs and why it's failed.
Absolutely. And necessary that this one volume should be written, but some of the pieces are out there, and let's go further. Because I want to get into our current situation and state of affairs, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
You know, you got to trace what happened in Afghanistan now. You got to take a look at what happened there. You got to take a look at the larger corporate interests who have now profited off of all of this, okay, one way or another, and created the prescription problem with the pills and the rest of it, okay? And now it's like, oh, it's an opioid crisis because, yeah, it finally got everywhere. When it was in the rough neighborhoods, nobody cared. Okay? It's all right. You know, almost like that scene from The Godfather, right? Let it stay in those neighborhoods. They're animals anyway. It's okay. And I got to tell you, I'm personally outraged by that, Selly. And as somebody who experienced it from various angles, look, man, this is going to reach us all eventually. If it continues to burn like it does.
And that's exactly what has happened with the opioid epidemic. Now, keep in mind, I've always said, because I did see satellite photos of the Amazon, mm-hmm. where thousands and thousands of cocaine labs were installed. And I said to the general once, I said, why can't we just napalm the whole fucking shit?
Yeah.
And his answer to me was, we need drug money for covert operations, so we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
So it goes back to that time period. And the chemicals, the drugs that are being produced in Mexico right now, mm-hmm. in Michoacán, where the main criminal that develops that drug that comes into the U.S., we know where he's at. Mm-hmm. Why don't we use a drone strike to take him out? We're not going to do that.
Well, you're assuming somebody wants to solve this problem, right? If you're saying
yeah, I'm assuming, that it's easy. The solution is very easy. The 10 most wanted FBI, they can be taken out any time.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't do it. They let it happen. But it hit the middle class, upper class, white communities,
right?
Massachusetts, up the East Coast, where nobody thought in their wildest dream that kids would be dropping like flies on the OD and on the drugs,
mm-hmm.
and you would think that because that would happen, they will stop it, but they don't, because money is more important than anything else.
No, see, and again,
I mean, imagine the money that's being seized. It's a very small percentage,
right,
of what they're reporting seized. I mean, it's just mind-boggling of why they don't stop it.
See, but it wasn't mind-boggling at one point, and I got to tell you why, right? When you were in 1979, right, doing what you were doing in New York City, tell you a little parallel story, not too far from you, was me. And you know what? I was a kid learning how to go into certain parts of the city. Quite frankly, there was a bunch of easy spots in the southern part of Harlem, you know, in South Harlem, where you could pick up a large quantity of heroin. Not a large quantity, not like, you know, kingpin size, but big enough that you could take it back to Jersey into another bad neighborhood, okay, and you could sell to the users there. No problem. Cheap. And you could pick it up easily, and it was just a car ride. It was just a trip through the Lincoln Tunnel, right? Not a big deal. Okay? And what did they do? They could put a kid like me on the corner. I told you. Hey, I'm a lookout. I'm doing this and that. All right. And, in fact, we could take the original brick pack that we got from over there and repackage it, whack it up, and make it bigger. Cheap. Easy. Not a problem. And you know what the real not a problem was? Is so long as it stayed in the neighborhoods of undesirables, nobody cared. Okay? And today, now with the corporate thing going on, the pills, they're making special, you know, GMO stuff that they're growing in Tasmania, you know, and sending that all over the place because now they can grind up the whole thing instead of just scoring the flour, right? Like they have to get the opium out. Okay? And then... Yeah. There's a few other trips down the line there where it gets processed into heroin. But fact is, that's where it starts. You could take that opium, that poppy straw now, right, and grind up the whole plant. More efficient, Selly, you know. And what was that done for? So you had Percocets. So you had Oxycontin, okay?
Right.
And then that became the more acceptable. At one point, a joke, and indeed, they used to call it hillbilly heroin, right? Because it was, you know, in the mountains over there in West Virginia, whatever. It's still poor people. It doesn't matter. But when it really went everywhere, now we got a whole other situation. Now it's a crisis, right? Okay. Right. And it is. It is. But is it the crisis that was allowed to happen? I say yes, all the way around. And I think you agree with me. But, I mean, what is it that could be done about this now? And oh, by the way, one last thing before I let you go on this. And please tell me what you think. This idea that fentanyl is a brand new thing. You don't know nothing if you think fentanyl is a brand new thing. Not you, Sally. I'm saying the listener. You know nothing if you think this is new. We had this stuff. At the time you were a cop in New York, we had this stuff to whack up the heroin that we got. From New York.
Yes, and that was also killing a lot of people because some people did not know what they were doing. And they were cutting that stuff, adding to it, and you know, give it a little bit more kick and stuff like that. But
we used to say the shot was too hot for some people. That's the way it was. Yes. Yeah.
Like the guy that produces it a lot now is Mencho in down in Michoacan. He's the number one kingpin that develops this. And how is it possible that if they got Pablo Escobar and they can't get this guy? You know? And they know where he's at and what he's doing.
Right.
His drugs are still coming across, and we get here in the border. We get a lot of Border Patrol agents getting arrested for smuggling drugs, and we have Homeland Security where they were involved and they were prosecuted for it. We have the checkpoints that have been compromised. The point of entrance have been compromised. That's how you get all this stuff. I've always said that as long as what reference to the United States government is that there are two things that they will never stop is undocumented individuals and drugs.
Well, that
because
brings...
They both depend on that.
Absolutely.
They both depend on that, and that's where they get money or covert operations where you don't have to follow the money because there's no way to follow the money. There's a history of it, how the CIA works this thing.
Yes, sir.
Well, and that's how they make their money.
Yeah, and look, I want to address one of the dumbest things that I hear out there from people. And, is you know, you want to talk about going to the horse's mouth. Here we go. Celly Castillo will know how to handle this. Okay, I hear this dumb thing all the time. That, oh, you know, those immigrants that come across the border, they're drug mules, you know, they're carrying this stuff on their backs and they're swallowing it and this. And I say, you know what? You guys have no idea how this really works, right? Because, oh, well, we see the big bust on the border. You know what? Cost of doing business. That's what they allow them to bust, first of all. Second, if you think these guys are carrying it in backpacks across, you know, the Rio Grande, you're out of your mind. It's not coming in that way. It's not. Now, yeah. Tell me I'm wrong, Celly.
No, you're absolutely right. 90% of the drugs that come into the United States, it's through the point of entry. They don't have to be smuggled. All they do is pay off the guys at the bridge.
That's it.
They pay them off, and the trailers just come... right through at the checkpoint. They know exactly who's working, and they're saying, you know, a certain hour, go through this lane and you'll go right through it.
Yep.
And that's how they're smuggled, and that's how it happens. Down the line you get stopped by Department of Public Safety or the sheriff's office or whoever. And sometimes they even had DPS vehicles escorting the trailers.
Yeah.
So they won't be stopped and so forth. And they'll always say, oh, it's a covert operation being run by the government. So, you know, stay away from it or let it go. Or don't mess with it. And that's just the way it happens. It's always happened that way. You see it in the news. Every so often where Border Patrol agents at the checkpoint get arrested after somebody's not happy with that somebody got more money than they did and so forth. And that's how it happens. You know, they start popping each other. So, you know, it happens a lot.
Right.
A lot. And
well, and the other thing is you see the big celebrated drug bust, right? And I say, yeah. You know what? That's what they let them catch. And people always shake their head at me when I say that. But the fact is, look, every once in a while, you got to let these guys look like they're doing the job, don't you?
Yes, I mean, exactly. And even it just look, it's real simple. In Mexico, when they have a drug bust, they have a dog and pony show. They put down all the drugs. They put down all the weapons. And then there's something that pops at you. You see a green grenade that's made by U.S. military. Mm-hmm. It's called M79 grenade launchers, and it's all military grade, U.S. military grade. How in the hell? You don't buy it at a gun shop or... those are strictly military. So how in the world do the cartels are getting these 50 cals, Barrett 50 cal rifles, the Quad 50s, the Browning 50 cals, all U.S. munitions? Mm-hmm. And nobody questions that. Nobody questions that at all.
No.
They're coming in from our armories at the National Guard. A lot of them are being shipped from the Middle East. Everybody has them. Not one cartel, but every single cartel and every organized crime units in Mexico have those M79s.
Right.
40 Mike Mikes, they call them. You know, they... It's just unbelievable. Those are grenades that are used on the launchers or the M204s and so forth. And it's just unbelievable how they get those rounds and nobody ever questions about how they got there.
You know, and we didn't even begin to touch on things like you know, each of these things are all part of the same problem, obviously, but they each have their own characteristics. I mean, methamphetamine is a huge business as well, right? I mean,
yes.
Look,
yes, yes.
I could tell you that personally, for me, right? I think that this whole idea about drug prohibition is foolish. I think that if it's treated as a medical issue, if it's treated as a social issue, as in, let's deal with why it is people want to get high in the first place, right? Let's deal with that. And if you remove the black market element from this, I mean, I know it would cost the CIA a lot of funding. But outside of that, you know, there is a way, I believe, if the approach is different, not about punitive actions. And this really, quite honestly, I mean, don't take offense to this, but it's like the drug war is a complete fake. Okay? Nobody is looking to stop this because there's too much money. The government's supposed to be preventing it. Quite frankly, a lot of times they're in business with it. We know this, and it goes across. It's not just, you know, the border agent that gets more money to let things come in than he's going to get paid. Okay, that's a simple thing on the ground. That's just, you know, the nature of the beast. When you have an industry that's making enough money illegally, the smart thing to do is to pay off the people that are supposed to be stopping you. I mean,
exactly.
That's just very simple.
Exactly. You know, going back to the Nixon era where he declared the war on drugs, mm-hmm. Since that time period to now, we haven't even made a dent on the so-called war on drugs.
No.
And there's a reason why. You know? Everybody is making money.
Mm. I mean, is it just that simple? I mean, is it just that simple? Because I got to tell you, I've known too many people that have lost their lives. You know, bad junk one way or another, not knowing the way this stuff really works and getting into it and destroying themselves. Other people have gotten involved, and you know, just again, like I told you, I don't make any apologies about it, but trying to survive at a certain point, there were people that got involved in this because it was handed to them generation to generation even. And it doesn't matter. The drug can change, but the business runs the same on the street. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And yeah, it's not one thing, it's the other one.
Exactly.
And then it comes back to the same thing. You know, back in the 80s was the heroin, but the cocaine came in. And then now it's the different pills and different stuff that's coming in. You know, not that that cocaine is not available, because it's available, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the marijuana farms in the U.S. now that they have good stuff out there, better than what Mexico used to develop. And it's a money-making machine. You know, it's never going to stop.
Mm-hmm. Now, and see, to me, cannabis is not even an issue. You know, people that are worried about that, I mean, come on. You know?
Yeah. Well, see, cannabis is as they found out, is good for everybody now.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not trying to criminalize it anymore. And, you know, it's just something that you know, we will learn to live with. But everything else that where kids are dropping like flies, then that's something they know it's bad, but they don't care. They don't care.
See, but the thing is, again, if this was approached differently and handled from the angle, like I said, how about figure out why it is that mm-hmm. people want to get high? Maybe, you know, if you don't generate so much desperation within the system itself, you don't have people looking to escape. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
And look at the
penal system for nonviolent cases, where a lot of people are being incarcerated. You know, so that's another topic that needs to be touched, of why so many people are being incarcerated.
Well, it's the whole of the thing, right? And if it was approached differently, you might not require the war on drugs. You know what
exactly.
I'm saying? you might not require so many drugs. I mean, yeah. You know, it's a different angle, and I can't see how this is even remotely sane the way that this thing has gone. And I was born in 1972, right? So there isn't a time in my life where this wasn't the issue. And I know that, let's be honest again, opium is something they keep repackaging one way or another. So obviously that's always going to be there. I mean, they used to put it in elixirs for menstrual cramps for women in the 1800s, right? I mean,
right.
They put it in common, all sorts of common products, and then somebody, lo and behold, developed heroin to get people off of morphine. That's a true story, by the way.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
You know, and then what do you do next? Well, let's make it a little more palatable. We'll repackage it. We'll call it something else. Now it's Percocet. It's Oxycontin. It's whatever, Lortab. I don't even know all the stuff at this point. I'm just saying, yeah. Over time, it keeps being repackaged, and why? Because there's a demand for it. And if that's the way it is, then why not figure out a way to make it safe, sane, and rational? You know, just like we said with the cannabis, where it's like, look, if it's just there, I mean, and it's not a black market issue, nobody's going to kill anybody over something they can get at the corner store, okay?
Right.
So, you know, I have never understood this where, nope, the only way to do this is with blunt force, is with, I think there's a lot of possibilities here, and unfortunately, you already gave us the answer. If there wasn't so much money involved, then maybe something else could be done. But with the last, you know, say 10 minutes here that I've got with you, because believe it or not, we've almost gone through 2 hours, and I really, again, want to thank you for indulging me and discussing this.
Well, it was my
pleasure. But I want to give you these last 10 minutes to kind of wrap around this whole thing and tell people precisely what it is you would like them to learn from your story and from all of the things that we've discussed, obviously, what they can see around them. I mean, what is the thing to learn, to take away, to make things better? You know what I mean? Like, what is it that somebody could learn here and make a difference with out of your story and all that we talk?
I've always said, Chuck, that the answer is education. Prevention, and things like that, educating the public of what is really going on, because a lot of people are trying to find out, and it's hitting them right in the face what the solution is, but they don't see it because of ignorance or whatever it is, that they're not gasping at it. They're not trying to. And to me, you have to just study it, educate yourself on what is really going on. Look at the history, you know. You know, we're not the greatest country in the world. We incarcerate more people than any other country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we failed at education. We're rated like 34 in the world. We why? Because whether we're being lazy or what's, you know, why do I have to learn the history when that's the past? And you have to look at the big picture, not the small picture. And that's what I have to say, that you have to, it has to be education. You have to hear it on radio talk shows, just like yours. We have a different generation now. But to me, it's the same generation. It's just they think and they're wired a little different than from us back in the day.
Right.
But now it's a different kind of world. It's a different breed of animal, and we have to save it. We have to save, because if we don't save this world, you know, that goes, there goes our grandkids and our great grandkids. You know, one loss is too many, especially if it involves your family.
Well, I think one loss is too many, whether it's my family or anybody else's.
That's what I meant. Yes,
everybody's life. Yes. It should not be wasted. It should not be just thrown away for the sake of somebody else's,
benefit.
Benefit, yeah. Exactly. You know, last thing, personal question, okay? And you don't got to answer it if you don't want to, and I would understand if you don't want to, but you mentioned PTSD, and over the long term, I had to learn myself that this is something that never really goes away. Look, just from some of the basics that I shared with you today about my younger years, right? You could imagine I might have been in places where some PTSD stays with me, right?
Right.
I mean, look, it's a dirty business, my brother.
Yeah.
So survive it.
PTSD can never, ever, ever be cured.
Well, no.
It can be controlled
a bit.
Controlled with medication. But you have to look at the big picture, because medication has so many side effects. One is suicide, you know? So that's why a lot of people, PTSD runs through several marriages. This is my third one.
Yeah.
And I'm done with that. I live by myself. You learn to live by yourself,
right?
Because of your PTSD.
Look, now, I'm on my third one too, and I want to tell you something. A weird thing that I discovered, and here's the thing also about this drug prohibition. Just honestly, and you might disagree with me here, but I can swear to you from personal experience. I used, believe it or not, psilocybin. Okay. And did it myself based on studies that I saw. And I know it's not legal and everything else, but people are doing studies with this. And quite frankly, I'll tell you just firsthand, it saved my life. I was, in one of those spaces, and I bet you know what it sounds like if I tell you, where, you're getting sucked down into it. And you don't know how to tell nobody. You don't know what to do. You go and you get the medications. These things are not always good. They make it worse, okay? And you don't even know how to explain this to somebody else. So I was like that. And to be honest with you, out of desperation, I reached out and did something to myself that maybe wasn't the most well-advised thing. But frankly, it saved my life, man. And, they're researching this now. So I want to see where it goes. But I can tell you firsthand that, I pray that you have yours under control and that nobody suffers like that.
One of the things that I do have, and I've had it for years and years, and I picked it up when I was 10 years old, that is the fact that I, throughout the years, I have a medication that controls my PTSD,
mm-hmm.
and that medication is art.
Hey.
Being an artist takes me into different zones. I paint and I draw 24/7. I paint till 3 o'clock in the morning and then sleep the rest. Art is one of the best self-medication you can have. And I didn't turn to alcohol. I didn't turn to drugs. I turned to art. And to me, it has helped me. I learned it from my dad. My dad, he used to get so upset for the stupidest thing. He yelled and screamed. And 30 seconds later, he'd tell my mom, "Honey, what's for dinner?" Nothing happened.
I know.
And here we are looking at him and says, "What is wrong with my dad?" And then that's just the way it is. But to me, I indulge myself into art. And until the day I die, that's what I'm going to do.
Well, no one size fits all on any of this.
Exactly.
Some people,
yes.
People are going to have to.
Some people work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Different ways. And I have friends that are moderate alcoholics. If there's such an animal, But, you know, they're in denial, and they'll drink every day. And now they drank since the Vietnam War.
Right.
And now it's catching up to them, their liver, their kidneys, their health. We're losing right now 500 Vietnam vets a day. When my dad passed away, there were 1,000 a day. He died at the age of 79. But now we're catching up to them, you know.
Right.
500 a day. If you Google that, you'll see we're losing 500 Vietnam vets a day.
Well, you know, there's a lot of issues there. And, again, my personal attachment due to my father, I would say it's because they were not properly taken care of. That's an issue for another discussion, because we're almost out of time. But but once again, you know, I would urge people, if you don't know Celi Castillo's story, I didn't give you the whole story during this interview, and neither did he, but we gave you a good look at it, I think. And really, I appreciate all of what you've said, all of the time that you put in, the energy you put into educating people so that they understand the reality of this circumstance, for sure. But it tells you a lot about the way the world is working around you, Celi. Not just about, you know, how drugs are and how the government's dealing with it and how they're dealing it. Okay, excuse me, but truth is truth, okay? You know, the operations that involve the trade for weapons, for people's lives, the benefits that people are able to reap from others' blood, one way or another. You know, I know it sounds like a dark downer to end on, but I'm not. It's hopeful, because you're educating people. You're letting them know, this is the way this worked for me. This is how it happened when you go in there with an honest desire to do the right thing, and you find out that the people you signed up with maybe are not on the side of doing the right thing like you are. Not at all. And in fact, you could just almost get yourself killed more than once trying to do your job. So, Celi, anything you want to say here just with the last minute, it's all yours, and we'll just close this on out.
Well, I, first of all, I want to thank you, because without you, we would not be having this discussion. And it's all about, like you said, education. We have to educate the public. We have to point at them a where to go. Don't take our words for it. You know, Google it. There's numerous documentaries and numerous documents of my allegations and so forth. And it's about education. And it was an honor and a privilege to be here with you again. And it's been quite a while, and hopefully we can do this again.
No, absolutely, and soon as possible. One quick mention here. I want to send a special thanks to the man who introduced you and me, Danny Romero. Good guy. I don't work with him anymore, but I always wish him well and can never thank him enough for introducing me to this man who is honorable and, quite frankly, is somebody who should be celebrated in my mind as a just an American hero. That's it. Celi Castillo, thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Have a good night.
Absolutely. Bye-bye. And I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect.